The Office of the State Historian is proud to present the New Mexico Digital History Project podcast series.
So thank you so much. It's really exciting to have the opportunity to talk about this work with people who care about the same ideas. And so I want to thank Dennis Trujillo and Esteban as well, who's not here, the State Historian, for putting together this lecture series and having this scholarship program, which seems like it brings in a lot of really interesting people to New Mexico to do interesting work. So, and I also want to thank the Valles Caldera Trust for being so supportive of this kind of a project, and particularly Anna Stefan, who's here, who noticed that I was coming back to work at the Valles Caldera Trust for multiple seasons on the biology field crew, but what I was really interested in was the cultural history. And so she said, why don't you look into the place names of the preserve? So I'm very grateful to her as well for helping me start up this project. So what I'm going to talk about today is a couple of different maps that I found while doing research in the archives here at the Center for Southwestern Research, and a couple of different documents that I'm sort of connecting to those maps. And I'm also going to talk about the project of cultural mapping of the Valles Caldera just as a whole project, which we wanted to start it out with an archival component, but it's really much to be expanded to a larger oral history project and ethnography project. So in the human imagination, maps arouse a sense of wonder and curiosity, right? This is a good map. This is the new map that we have at the Valles Caldera, and it doesn't seem like the most mysterious map, but when you consider all of the unknown areas and still the unnamed places on the landscape, it's a wonderful place to begin wondering and imagining about what this place means to people. So maps may claim objective representation or serve to emphasize and describe the importance of certain elements of the environment, but what they choose to include, exclude, and represent reflects particular cultural and historic values. So in this way, maps may be interpreted as projections of our worldviews and our perceptions of space. Similarly, the words with which we label and organize the map, the place names, are richly embedded with cultural historical values. So on the Valles Caldera National Preserve, we're beginning to study place names to elucidate the cultural landscape. The preserve, as most of you know, has a federal mandate to manage the land using science-based adaptive management, which means taking into consideration all of the different stakeholders on the preserve. So that includes the ranchers and various indigenous groups, the recreationalists, the biologists and geologists and archaeologists, and all different people who have an interest in this landscape. Our understanding of the cultural landscape, therefore, is not one that can be fixed in content or in its meaning. The landscape is not static, and among the many dynamic processes that shape the Valles Caldera, humans and human culture have played a vital and interesting role. So a cultural mapping project essentially serves to comprehend and integrate the multiple voices and languages of groups and individuals who hold associations with the landscape. So today I'm going to talk about the historical perspective on the kind of present situation. And I'm presenting it sort of as a collection of stories, because there are so many stories that come out of the archives and out of the history of the preserve. And as I was pulling together all of the stories, I realized that I didn't have a very clear sort of linear narrative to that. So I'm going to just talk about the different stories, and my hope is that I'll be able to integrate the ideational values that people have with the preserve that comes out of these stories, as well as the interest in the material elements of the preserve. So we're going to look at three maps. Well, we're looking at one now. And we're also going to look at the geology map, the Smith, Bailey, and Ross geology map, and talk a little bit about the evolution of the name Bias Caldera and how we came to the name Bias Caldera from beginning at Valles de los Vacas, which was the first map where we see the caldera documented from 1779. And then we're going to look at a map from 1909 that was commissioned by the Redondo Development Company, which was a Pennsylvania firm that purchased the land around the turn of the century and attempted to begin developing it. And we're going to look at that map and as a way of talking about how at the turn of the century, the land was being viewed very much in terms of its material resources and how we can make a profit off of it, and sort of exploring what that means and what the effects are of that. And then finally, I'm going to talk about something that I'm calling vernacular mapping, which is looking at people's individual or groups' attachments to the landscape that might be material but are largely ideational and immaterial, and how those can be expressed through place names. So with the vernacular map, I've recruited various people who have had experiences on the preserve and have different attachments to it, and had them add their own place names to the map. So, and I'm going to talk about that. I don't have a projection of that, but I have it on a watercolor sheet, because even though I'm not a watercolor painter, it seemed like a good way to begin to represent the land. So, since we're not at the preserve, I was going to read a passage from N. Scott Momaday's novel Housemaid of Dawn, which takes place on Jaime's Pueblo. And he writes about, and this novel, by the way, is fantastic, and it was really the first novel by an indigenous writer that sort of brought indigenous writing to mainstream consciousness, and it won a Pulitzer Prize. And he says this about the Valles Caldera. Okay. In the morning sunlight, the Valle Grande was dappled with the shadows of the clouds and vibrant with rolling winter grass. The clouds were always there, huge, sharply described, and shining in the pure air. But the great feature of the valley was its size. It was almost too great for the eye to hold, strangely beautiful and full of distance. Such vastness makes for illusion, a kind of illusion that comprehends reality, and where it exists, there is always wonder and exhilaration. So that vastness of the landscape is something that we don't understand as well today since we drive vehicles in it. But the first name of the caldera that I had mentioned before on the map of 1779 by Bernardo Miera y Pacheco, shows the Valle Grande to be multiple times its actual size. So, and he calls it Valles de los Vacas, which has been translated often as Valley of the Cows, but I believe that it's actually referring specifically to the Baca family. But there's not a lot of information as to what the Baca family's connection was to the landscape at this point. What we know is that it was commonly used. It was a commonly used landscape. So, and the reason why I believe that we should stop translating it as Valles de los Bacas is because Baca is a feminine noun when it means cow, and it, because it's Los Bacas, it should be referred to the family. So we learned from this map that at this point the caldera had yet to be measured. Right? Then according to the Survey General record, at the time of the land grant acquisition in 1860, the land was country known as Valles Grandes. The land grant is made to the Baca family to settle a dispute over two grants made previously. And the landscape becomes called Baca Float Number 1 and then Baca Location Number 1, and it keeps this name throughout various land tenures. The name Valles Caldera that we have today is given by the geological community and comes out of very interesting stories about the arguments over what the caldera actually was geologically. And Robert Smith was the geologist who was in charge of mapping parts of the Jemez at this point. And I'm going to just show the map that they made. So it was in the 60s that, well, it was really in the 30s when Robert Smith began working in the Jemez and thinking about these issues. And he, up until the 50s, it was believed that the caldera was actually a large crater, and geologists didn't quite understand the concept of the resurgent dome. So it took Robert Smith a while to actually convince the geological community in the Jemez that this actually was a caldera. And once he did, then the name, we were able to have the name caldera, though keeping the Valles, I think, is very nice, because the Valles ultimately describes the visual aspect of the landscape, but it also harkens back to the investment that so many Spanish sheep herders essentially had in the landscape. So the work on the geological history is actually one that will be undertaken as an oral history. But because this grant was about the archival research, I'm going to talk about that now. And it brings us to another map, one of the maps that's in the archives. So doing research about place names in the archives here was at times very discouraging, because the people who kept records of their relationship with the landscape were largely driven economically. And so what you find are a lot of inventory as to the resources that could be used to make a profit, and different kinds of developments that could be made, timber to be harvested, minerals to be extracted, and valleys to be grazed with livestock. So what I found in the archives was a lot of discussion about these particular resources and a very material kind of quantified perspective on the landscape. And I believe that there are, the archives are so enormous that I'm sure that there would be collections that I could find other stories in, but in the span of time of my research, pretty much what I found was this very economic view of the land. So those really begin in around the turn of the century, at the time that the Redondo Development Company purchases the caldera from the Valles Land Company, which was owned by the Otero family. And the point, I believe, about how we perceive the landscape in this material way is illustrated well with this map. So in 1909, the Redondo Development Company purchased the location, and they commissioned Shelton, who was a private surveyor, to classify the land into categories for development. And Shelton mapped the timberlands, the natural meadows, and then called the rest mountainous and worthless sections. So the map really provides a snapshot into this moment of the history of the caldera, where where essentially certain changes would take place that then would have much longer ecological effects. And one of the materials I found in the archives that was particularly interesting was in the papers of Willard Hopewell, who was a politician and also involved with the Redondo Development Company. And he originally had come from Canada, but he had made a lot of connections in New Mexico and sort of provided the connection from the Pennsylvania firm to come to New Mexico and purchase the land. So about 7 years before this map is made, a report is sent to Congress requesting statehood for New Mexico and Arizona and Oklahoma. And Willard Hopewell himself was involved with the Committee on the Territories. And so although this report wasn't written by him, it serves to really give us a sense of the values associated with the lands in the West at this time. And it also, we see how people's interest in the material resources of Western lands were very much tied up with a discourse about what it means to be an American citizen and what is really the goal of living a good life and what is human happiness. So the report says that, or the report requests, to enable the people of New Mexico to form a constitution and state government and to be admitted into the Union on an equal footing with the original states. To enable the people of New Mexico to share the rights and privileges of the states of the Union, an argument is developed in the report as to why New Mexico is worthy of statehood. And this argument openly states the need for a rapid development of the natural resources. So I'm just going to read a few parts from the report. It starts out talking about how recently Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines have become territories, and how this isn't really fair for the Western states, that they should have the same political representation that these new places have. So they write, "The comparison is not an inviting one when the newcomers to the national fold, the Hawaiian, the Puerto Rican, and the Filipino, are placed side by side as to political rights with the pioneers of American civilization in the Great West, those who were born under the flag and have lived under it, fought for it, and under its protection have made American homes, founded American towns and cities, built schoolhouses and churches and public buildings, brought the soil to cultivation, opened the mines, cleared the forests, and made states in fact, if not in name." And it goes on, "The material advancement of the inhabitants of the territory depends largely upon the rapid development of the resources of the territory. The power of Congress is a constant menace to progress, and there is no way a territory may escape it. Untold riches, abundance of all that makes for human happiness, and prosperous and populous commonwealths await emancipation from the thraldom of territorial existence." So you can see it's very dramatic language. "In all the territories, the population is distinctly American." I'm still reading from the report. Okay. "The best type of American, made up of those who seek life's prizes by toil and patience. Of what manner of men this population is made up, let their words speak. Cities and towns, with all that modern civilization demands, homes of culture and refinement, schools and higher institutions of learning, public and private charitable institutions, everywhere the free church and free press. These are not the monuments of the Indian nor the Mexican, the idle nor the vicious." So it's fairly disturbing, especially when we look at the kind of damage that was done by the logging industry to the caldera after this, that there were so many values tied up with the business, and that it was really an identity issue for Americans at this time, that we had the right to open the mines and clear the forests. And it really emphasizes a very particular way of looking at the landscape, and one that is not necessarily sustainable. But I think most importantly, it just provides a particular cultural moment where we are interested more in the land for its material resources than anything else. So the archives provide a very useful narrative in this way, but to really comprehend the full cultural landscape of the Valles Caldera, I believe it will be necessary to talk to people and to collect stories of different people who have lived and worked and experienced the land in some way. So now I'm going to talk about the vernacular map, because that's sort of the purpose of that. The purpose is not to create a static representation of the landscape, but rather it's to invoke the imagination and cause wondering about what this place means to people. By vernacular maps, I mean to describe maps which illustrate sometimes a common knowledge of the landscape among select groups, sometimes the perception of the land or the meaning for an individual, and sometimes the places of experiences and shared memory. It is a way of describing the significance of the landscape as it is known by common people who have, as I said, worked and been involved and developed relationships with the landscape. So the vernacular map seeks to illustrate the significance of the landscape in its immaterial value to people, as well as bring together the multiple voices that compose the cultural landscape. In a place of rich and diverse cultural history, as the Valles Caldera, the multiplicity of voices often feel like a cacophony of concerns. Yet it seems that these voices may be rendered more poetic and vivid on this kind of variegated map. So different individuals who hold associations with the caldera have added their own place names, which reflect their personal knowledge and experience on the caldera. One wrote, "Cima de las Lajas, summit of flat rocks, lichen-covered, large, broken, exploded, and piled in great heaps, an inspiration for rock fences." Other place names are "A Chorus Frog Place," "Prairie Dog Becomes Lunch Place," "Old Cosme Herrera Homestead," "Campo de Salomon Lobato," who is, this is right outside of the preserve boundary, but it's a man who sets up a huge camp every 4th of July, and it's apparently a legendary event. And "A Place to Hide All Day," and "A Great Quiet." So it is my hope that mapping the place names and gathering the stories will continue to animate our understanding of the landscape, and hopefully will lead us to a more integrated view between how we value the landscape for its material resources and how we perceive it as a place of ideational meaning and identity. So, thank you very much. So, and there are a lot of people here from the Valles Caldera. So, if you wanted to have a Q&A, we can also make it kind of an open dialogue, I was thinking. So I don't know if people have questions, but. Yes, and I have the map here if you want to look at it.
Did anybody have any questions or comments that they want to add?
Yeah, I think that the idea is that if we create a GIS database, then we can have all of the different layers of place names and different languages. And the nice thing about having all of these names in a GIS database is that you could have a whole formal layer of information that, say, came right from the archives. And then you could also have a layer of individuals expressing their their personal experiences on the landscape. And then you could have a whole layer of just traditional names that have been used for so long. So I think what's interesting about looking at it all on one map is that you begin to see just how different the names can be from one another. And sometimes looking at them, you can actually sense the discord between the two names. But looking at them all on one map is a way of beginning to understand whether it's possible to have an ongoing dialogue between so many different stakeholders. Yes?
Mm-hmm. And I wonder how many of those named places are in that book are in the Valle.
Yeah. How many of the names are in the Valle? In terms of specifically where he's done research on these names? Actually, not very many of them. I mean, for example, the place name that I'm really curious about is Toledo, because that's my favorite place on the Valle. And the name, what Bob Julian says about Toledo is that it's a common Spanish surname. And, you know, it's a place in Spain. So when that name came to the Valle specifically, I'm not sure. And that's probably going to be best understood through talking with people whose first language is Northern Mexican Spanish, and kind of collecting the stories of the history of the area. And otherwise, one of the best resources, I think, for the place names on the Caldera is a dictionary of Northern New Mexico, Southern Colorado Spanish, because that gives the real particular definitions for the region. So, for example, abrigo means, a lot of people think of that word as meaning raincoat, but it's actually really describes like a wrap of a kind of some sort of a wool wrap. And I was speaking with someone about it recently who said, you know, that's what sheep herders wear. They wear abrigos. So when I look at many of the place names, I think very much of the sheep herding. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question, because I was looking for any kind of different voice in the archives, and I really didn't find anything until the 1970s, when the Save the Jemez group forms and local environmentalists begin organizing to protect some of the resources, and then a group who calls themselves Save Us from Save the Jemez, of local people living in Jemez Springs, form to stop the Save the Jemez group from taking away their personal rights on the forest and land. So.
Um,
it goes back, I mean, really, since the Spanish arrived, they were herding sheep in the caldera, it seems. It pretty much stopped once it was no longer profitable after World War II, when so many synthetic fabrics became available that people no longer needed wool, and soldiers didn't need wool uniforms anymore. And at that point, they took the sheep off and switched to cattle. But I think part of the appeal of the sheep herding is that the sheep herders had a very strong sense of place in the caldera, and there are still a lot of stories about the sheep herding days that are very interesting and compelling. And there are also, on some of the older maps as well, there are sheep dips labeled all over. In Sulphur Springs, they would bring the sheep to Sulphur Springs to dip them in the waters there to clean them of scabs and ticks and things. So I think there's some romanticism associated with sheep herding that makes it stick and remain significant. There's also all of the aspen carving all over the preserve from sheep herders that is interesting. And they left their very personal signs of their time on the landscape, on the caldera. They are fairly reserved in how much they share about the names, though that's beginning to change this season, I guess. But you know, in the oral history collection, in the Native American oral history collection that was done in the 70s that we have here in the Center for Southwestern Research, they interview a bunch of elders from Jemez Pueblo. And there's one interview that's very painful to listen to because the interviewer is saying, "So do you have a name for Mount Taylor?" And the woman says, "I don't know." They say, "What do you call Mount Taylor?" And they say, she says, "I don't know. Go ask the boys. I don't know." And so it's a sensitive topic, and it's not a place that I personally am yet entitled to begin researching, because it's not information that has been recorded and filed into the archives.
Do you get a sense, though, that that's like Mount Taylor, that is a sacred area to the Native Americans?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. The caldera is a sacred place for a lot of different tribes all over the Southwest. And it shows up in a lot of creation myths and things like that. And Kurt Anschutz actually writes about it as in terms of the relationship between the edge and the center in indigenous cultures, that is to say, and he sort of makes the argument that every cultural group has this, which is that you have your place of home and your center, and then you have these places that are on the fringes of your social gathering place or your home that are sort of like liminal places. There are these thresholds that might be a threshold between, you know, the human world and some other realm. And so one idea is that in the Anglo-American culture, the concept of wilderness is that kind of edge. And that a lot of Anglo-Americans would very much like to see the caldera be a wilderness place. So it has it doesn't completely answer your question because I don't know enough about the all of the different tribes and their cultural practices, but we do know, and most people here who work on the caldera know that, for example, we don't go to the top of Redondo Peak because it's a sacred peak. And the Santa Clara, which borders the preserve, they have use and access where they can come in to practice rituals. And when geothermal exploration was going on, the UNM Archaeology Field School, I guess, did a survey of the area in Redondo Meadow on the caldera that was going to be used for drilling, and did a project looking at the religious associations with the caldera by different tribes, and just came up with a whole wealth of information. And the tribes really fought to not have that that area of the preserve drilled because they said, this is our church. So. Yeah, so it was formed by, it's a collapsed caldera, so it was formed, they finally were able to determine that it was, that it had been magma from below, it erupted and then it caused the collapse in. They were able to sort of prove that by looking at the bandolier tuff and the surrounding ash and connecting that to the landscape. And so it was an interesting idea that they basically solved a very interesting puzzle about that process through looking at the materials outside and around and not the caldera itself. That's a great question, and I don't know exactly what was lost, but I do know that the Pueblo Revolt was extremely successful in obliterating a lot of Spanish Entrada records. So in terms of finding more documentation about earlier land use, I'm very curious about that, what kind of documentation might have existed before 1680, when the first Spanish explorers were moving through the area and discovering the valles. And I don't know, maybe Dennis could say more about that. But yeah, I don't know. I haven't done enough research into that to know sort of how they would determine what was lost, but just all the information about the colonies was destroyed. So, and you can find some of it that they kept in Spain. But, so. Does anyone want to add anything?
Besides the Orcus, are there any other projects going on? Are they excavating?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. And, yeah, and Anna could probably say something about that because she's our cultural resource coordinator. But there are a lot of studies going on looking at primarily the lithic scatters in the preserve because there's so much obsidian and other cultural resource projects. But it's what's interesting is that that's not, I guess, really disseminated well to the public. So that's something, because the same thing is going on. There's a lot of biology studies going on the preserve that people don't know about. And so that's something else that the Valles Caldera Trust will work to do a better job at disseminating that information. But I don't know if you want to say something about that. Yeah, that's the hope. I mean, with John, our GIS coordinator, and anyone who wants to contribute to it, we can build a database in that way to have all of the different names, and then we could have it online so that people could access it and you could pull up different images and different stories connected to these place names and all of the variants that go with it. So that's sort of would be the best next stage of this project.